Hello and welcome to Hindsight here on RN. I'm Lorena Allam. Today, a truly fantastic tale. In 1938, on the eve of World War II, the power of radio was clearly shown through the impact of one, now infamous, broadcast. A young actor and writer called Orson Welles had written a radio play based on H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds. It was cleverly disguised as a music program, punctuated by a series of fake but believable news broadcasts telling of a Martian invasion. Within hours, news outlets reported widespread hysteria. But just how real was the panic? British cultural historian Christopher Frayling examines the true story behind the most notorious hoax in radio.
Our guest today, a giant among men in every possible way, an actor, director, producer, author, a designer, a cartoonist, a magician, a columnist, a wit, and a bon vivant, Mr. Orson Welles.
David, can I tell a story?
Yes.
We had a kind of ham radio, you know, amateur radio voice that was describing the arrival of the Martians.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere, coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
And there's dead silence. The real trick we did was to hold dead silence on a full network with no sound at all.
Yes.
And then you'd hear the microphone drop. And then more silence, and then this one little voice of the amateur radio saying, this is such and such. Is there anybody on the air? Is there any? More silence, you see. And that's, I guess, when they put the towels on their heads and ran out. I don't know why they put towels on their heads, but they did.
Did they really? They really did.
I don't know what that was going to do.
We believed in God. But this was beyond God. This was coming from another world.
Old Sam Dye, Hildy Benson, Mr. Brondish, and Mr. Benson. Immediately Sam Dye says, well, gosh damn, I'm going after my shotgun. And we were all loaded to shoot something. Because the shotgun was a cure for everything.
On the night before Halloween 1938, a 23-year-old theatre and radio producer brought a story of invasion live to America. Hitler had recently annexed Austria and stories of invasion were in the air. But this one was from the skies and from much further afield than Europe. It's been said that Orson Welles' radio broadcast of the War of the Worlds panicked the nation. Some headed for the hills, some stayed there for days, others grabbed shotguns or hid in churches or contemplated suicide. It was even rumoured that there were 40 or more deaths as a result of the panic.
Was I looked at this place and I said to myself, I wonder if I'll ever get back here again. I wonder if maybe some archaeological society will come and look at this and say, well, these people left because of the Martians.
Rising up now and the crowd falls back. There seem plenty that have stopped the description till I can take a new position. Hold on, will you please? I'll be right back in a minute.
I think I was more frightened then than I was sitting on a Rhine River guarding a bridge during the Second World War and afraid of German paratroopers landing and slitting my throat. It was brought out in a program that they were invincible and end of the world. That's it.
There were pockets of people who may have been panic-stricken, but their numbers in no respect reaches nationwide dimension.
All your dreams are over now, and all your wings have fallen down.
Oh, the fear that night has been dramatically overstated. And after all, that makes for a good story, doesn't it?
Some, such as Professor W. Joseph Campbell, are now wondering if this panic really did sweep the whole nation.
This radio play aired on the eve of Halloween, and Americans and 75 years ago, not being perhaps as sophisticated or worldly or media savvy as they are today, you know, bought the story hook, line, and sinker, and the country was plunged into panic and hysteria. I mean, it's a great yarn. It's a great story.
I've never had a friend in my life who wanted to see a magic trick, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know anybody who wants to see a magic trick. So I do it professionally. It's the only way I get to perform.
Orson Welles was never content with telling stories in straightforward ways. He saw himself as a kind of conjurer with words and images and performances. Here he is on Leslie McGahey's BBC Arena programme from 1982.
Didn't you play King Lear at the age of 9?
No. I played Mary the Mother of Jesus at the age of 13.
Even better?
Yes. Very good in drag. But no, didn't touch King Lear until later on.
How much of this, the whole business of the child prodigy is...
The musical part of it is true. I was one of those abominable little creatures, you know, with a baton, and I played the violin, and I played the piano, and...
But all the other stuff about being studied as a child prodigy...
Yes, I was, sort of, yes. I was, because everybody told me from the moment I was able to hear that I was absolutely marvelous. I never heard a discouraging word for years, you see. I didn't know what was ahead of me. I painted and they said nobody's ever seen such painting, you know. I played, nobody's ever played like that. And it just seemed to me no limit to what I could do.
By the age of 2, he was said to be speaking in complete sentences and amazing those around him. His mother Beatrice, an accomplished pianist and advocate of women's rights, encouraged his early interest in all the arts and taught him to read before formal schooling. She was also a keen practical joker. As a teenager, Orson Welles adapted Shakespeare's history plays into a single evening's entertainment, and in Harlem, New York, at the age of 20, he staged Macbeth with an all-black cast transposed from Scotland to Haiti.
Writers and actors contribute their share to the cultural development of the community. The Negro Theatre Unit of the Federal Theatre Project produced a highly successful version of Shakespeare's immortal tragedy Macbeth.
Orson Welles was determined to be different, to make an effect. And like him or not, the critics, especially in New York, were beginning to take notice.
Orson Welles has come to be the most famous name of our time in American drama. Says Collier's Magazine, 23-year-old Orson Welles threw a bombshell into Broadway. Robert Benchley writes in The New Yorker,
the production of The Mercury is, I should say, just about perfect.
Time Magazine declares, the brightest moon that has risen over Broadway in years. Welles should feel at home in the sky, for the sky is the only limit which his ambitions recognize.
As well as theatre, the young Orson Welles had radio in his sights, already the main medium of home entertainment in America, and increasingly the way people consumed the daily news. John Gosling, author of Waging the War of the Worlds, has studied that broadcast of 1938, as has Susan Douglas of the University of Michigan.
Well, radio was becoming a very intimate part of people's lives at this time. We're talking about 32 million households within the United States. And at that time, roughly 1940, you're looking at an estimated 27 million radios in use.
Really big media events, fireside chats, Joe Louis boxing matches, some of the most popular shows on radio, you know, radio comedy, they would have 40 million listeners. You know, when Namus and Andy debuted in the late 1920s, it became so popular that hotels had to pipe the show into their lobbies. There were movie theaters that would stop showing the movie so that people could hear the latest installment. Toilets were not flushed during that 15-minute period.
Radio was really supplanting newspapers as the predominant form of news information and opinion as well.
People really trusted radio. They believed that this was, if anything went wrong, that's where they should go. The first thing they should do is turn on the radio and hear what people are saying.
Joanna Burke, author of Fear, A Cultural History.
Autumn 1938 was a very anxious time for a lot of Americans.
5 months have gone by since I last spoke to the people of the nation about the state of the nation.
Roosevelt, just a few months earlier, had broadcast this great famous speech where he says the program that we have for economic and social revival has failed.
In this decision, I have been strengthened by the thought that by speaking tonight, there may be greater peace of mind. For to reach a port, we must sail. Sail, not lie at anchor. Sail, not drift. Drift. Drift.
It was 1938. A banking crisis and a deep economic recession were still shaking America's confidence. And overseas, there was daily news of fascist dictatorships in Italy and Germany. But Americans, said their president, had nothing to fear but fear itself.
Don't worry, we can sort it out. The worst thing is to be afraid. Listening to that speech, of course, a lot of people suddenly became aware that actually they ought to be afraid.
Unemployment was around 19%. There was a lot of anxiety about the economy. And in addition, there was a lot of anxiety about whether there was going to be another world war.
Of course, people are beginning to realize that there is a war coming up.
People could hear by shortwave transmission Hitler's increasingly inflammatory speeches.
We interrupt this program of the Berkshire Music Festival to bring you a transatlantic two-way conversation between Prague, Czechoslovakia, and New York.
Orson Welles' great insight, supported by his associate producer John Houseman, was to exploit this anxiety rather than sing about it by making an old story seem as if it was in the headlines again.
They used to tell me I was building a dream, and so I followed the mob. When there was earth to plow or guns to bear, I was always there.
The Columbia Broadcasting System and its affiliated stations present Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater on the air in The War of the Worlds by H.G. Wells.
People believed anything they heard on the radio. And I said, let's do something impossible and make them believe it and then tell them, show them that it's only radio. So that was what started it.
Ladies and gentlemen, the director of the Mercury Theater and star of these broadcasts, Orson Welles.
We know now that in the early years of the 20th century, this world was being watched closely by intelligences greater than man's, yet as mortal as his own. We know now that as human beings busied themselves about their various concerns.
The 22-year-old Orson Welles had founded the Mercury Theatre Group in New York City with John Houseman. CBS Radio wanted to enhance their programming with live drama as well as the standard variety shows, so they offered Welles' Mercury Theatre a series of their own. The group proceeded to dramatise classic novels and stories in new ways, while Welles dashed between studio and theatre and back again. John Gosling.
Welles was not heavily involved in a lot of these radio shows. He always had a lot of balls in the air, so he was kept busy at the end of the day. So what he tended to do was rely on this team, and it was, you know, an extraordinary bunch of people that he'd gathered around him, both actors and technicians, you know, Agnes Moorehead, Joseph Cotten, and of course he had Houseman and he had Koch as his key writer on these projects.
Here's John Houseman speaking to the BBC back in 1988 for the radio documentary entitled We Interrupt This Programme.
The series was Orson's series. Since I was his partner, I acted as associate producer with him and editor, and for a while I wrote them.
There was a time when I never got out of bed because I never had time to get out of bed, so I would lie in bed and write the radio shows simply because I had no time.
They had a week to prepare for each show, and producer John Houseman, together with scriptwriter Howard Koch, who'd later go on to co-write Casablanca, were constantly working against the clock.
The writer, Howard Koch, and John Houseman were terrified about this play. H.G. Wells had set it in England. It was a 40-year-old story. They thought the audience was going to die of boredom. They kept rewriting it and rewriting it, and they just kept thinking it was a complete and utter failure. And so they kept working it, working it, and came upon the device of having news broadcasts, news bulletins, interrupt the initial programming, which was Ramon Raquello and his orchestra.
The
Ladies and gentlemen, we interrupt our program of dance music to bring you a special bulletin from the Intercontinental Radio News.
Nobody had done this before.
Central Time, Professor Farrell of the Mount Jennings Observatory, Chicago, Illinois, reports observing several explosions of incandescent gas occurring at regular intervals on the planet Mars.
He conducted these shows as if he was conducting an orchestra. He could conduct the sound effects and the acting, and he knew every moment to pause something, to bring something, to bring some music up.
The beginning of that show is very boring. It's supposed to be. That was the whole trick. But Orson emphasized that, and Orson carried that a step much further than we would have had the nerve to do, anybody.
We take you now to Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
An early decision was to shift the story of the War of the Worlds from the home counties, not to a big city, but to Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Scriptwriter Howard Koch.
I didn't have much time, and I spread the map out on the top of the desk and closed my eyes, put the pencil down, landed on Grover's Mills as where the first Martian machine was to land.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Carl Phillips again out at the Wilmot Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey. Professor Pearson and myself made the 11 miles from Princeton in 10 minutes. Well, I hardly know where to begin. To paint for you a word picture of the strange scene before my eyes, like something out of a modern Arabian Nights. Well, I just got here. I haven't had a chance to look around
and
yet.
And the fact is that by about 13 minutes into the show, something had to happen because the show was so boring that it was not possible that a show would be. And then, very slowly, it started to accelerate.
It must have struck on its way down. But I can see the object itself doesn't look very much like a meteor, at least not the meteors I've seen. It looks more like a huge cylinder. It has a diameter of...
It was so scary, and the way it was put on, and to land at Grover's Mills, that's where we always went ice skating, you know, it's a great big pond.
They wanted it to really seem like a breaking news story, where they are naming actual places, and Grover's Mills was a real place, and so all of those details also added a deal of verisimilitude to it.
Dropped in your backyard. A step closer, please. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Mr. Wilmot.
Well, I was listening to the radio.
Closer and louder, please.
Pardon me?
Louder, please, closer.
Yes. I was listening to the radio and kind of drowsing. That professor fellow was talking about Mars. So I was half chosen, half...
Yes, Mr. Wilmot, and then what happened?
The makers of Chase and Sanborn Coffee, the superb blend you know is fresh, present the Chase and Sanborn Hour, and your host, Don Amici.
The War of the Worlds was airing on the CBS channel. On the other major channel, NBC, ventriloquist Edgar Bergen and his dummy Charlie McCarthy were hosting the Chase and Sanborn Hour, compared by the actor Don Amici. Much more popular than Wells' highbrow offerings on the other side.
Hello from Nelson Eddy, Dorothy L'Amour, Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Robert Ambrose.
Charlie McCarthy was a dummy and Bergen was a ventriloquist. The ventriloquist is throwing his voice, ends up being a hugely popular radio show. And so that was the big blockbuster show that was airing opposite War of the Worlds.
4 weeks now, and I'll be dogged if I can figure him out.
Yeah, well, don't try it, Judy. We all have the same trouble. Well, now another one has come along, and it looks like just as big a hit. It's by Hoagy Carmichael, and it's called, simply enough, Two Sleepy People. Dorothy L'Amour shows how it goes, and very nicely, too. Dorothy?
People then were no different. They got bored, and they twiddled the dial. And they tended to twiddle the dial more often than not when someone was singing a song.
Look at you and look at me, just two wilted flowers. We should get a cuckoo clock.
So about 11 minutes into the show, Dorothy L'Amour came on and sang what must be said as a fairly dreary song.
Got a cigarette?
A large number of people twiddled their dial at this moment, and the misfortune was they landed right in the middle of the assault on Grover's Mill. As you can just imagine, somebody tuning into this and having absolutely no idea what's going on. They could have thought it was Germans, they could have thought it was anything, but they certainly would have thought, this really does sound real.
The top blue! Look out there! Stand back!
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the most terrifying thing I've ever witnessed. Wait a minute. Wait a minute. Someone's pounding someone.
Out
of
the house.
Something I can see... Turning out of that black hole, two luminous disks.
The eyes, it might be a face, might be almost... Good heavens, something wriggling out of the shadow like a gray snake. Now it's another one and another one and another one. They look like tentacles to me. Oh, yeah, I can see the thing's body now. It's large. It's large as a bear. It glistens like wet leather, but that face... Ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The eyes are black and they gleam like a serpent. The mouth is a kind of V-shape with saliva dripping from its rimless lips. It seems to quiver and pulsate. And the monster or whatever it is can hardly move. It seems weighed down by possibly gravity or something. The thing's rising up now and the crowd falls back. It seems plenty. The most extraordinary experience, ladies and gentlemen. I can't find words. Well, I'll pull this microphone with me as I talk. I'll have to stop the description until I can take a new position. Hold on, will you, please? I'll be right back in a minute.
For some of those listening to their radios in New Jersey that Halloween Eve, the experience was terrifying.
And at 8 o'clock, it was nice music while I was doing my homework.
Grover's Mill resident, Dick Stives.
And all of a sudden, it broke in with this interruption. We interrupt this program because of...
We are bringing you an eyewitness account of what's happening on the Wilmoth Farm, Grover's Mill, New Jersey.
And then the Martians have landed, and then they're in Grover's Mills. And I immediately unplugged the radio. This is up over the tavern. I took it downstairs, put it on a bar, plugged it in, and asked everybody to be quiet.
We immediately dropped our cards.
Grover's Mill local, Hank Sears.
And we were down to Grover's Mill within... I'd say at the most 35, 40 seconds. I mean, we flew down there.
Ladies and gentlemen, am I on? Ladies and gentlemen, here I am, back of a stone wall that adjoins Mr. Wilmer's garden. From here, I get a sweep of the whole scene. I'll give you every detail as long as I can talk and as long as I can see.
The farmers start listening. I can name half of them, probably. Old Sam Dye, and Hildy Benson, and Mr. Brondish, and Mr. Benson.
More state police have arrived. They're drawing up a cordon in front of the pit. About 30 of them.
So immediately Sam Dice says, well, gosh, damn, I'm going after my shotgun.
No need to push the crowd back now. They're willing to keep their distance. The captain's conferring with someone. Can't quite see who.
And now everybody's getting a shotgun, and they're coming back. And now we're going to Grover's Mills. And I, a young 13-year-old, I also have a shotgun. I'm going, too.
I can see it now. It's a white handkerchief tied to a pole. Flag of truce. If those creatures know what that means, what anything means. Wait a minute, something's happening. A humped shape is rising out of the pit. I can make out a small beam of light against a mirror. What's that? There's a jet of flame springing from that mirror and it leaps right at the advancing men. It strikes them head on. Lord, they're turning into flames. Now the whole field's caught up by the woods as far as the gas tanks of the automobiles spreading everywhere. Coming this way now, about 20 yards to my right.
Then all of a sudden, all hell broke loose. They all had their so-called weapon in their car, and they're going.
While some grabbed their shotguns, others fled. And when the transmission went dead, the most frightening moment of the broadcast, the highways became jammed, with cars heading from New Jersey to New York and Pennsylvania.
Ladies and gentlemen, due to circumstances beyond our control, we are unable to continue the broadcast from Grover's Mill. Evidently, there's some difficulty with our field...
Grover's Mill resident, Dick Stives.
I don't know if it was 8 cars or 13 cars, but I jumped into one, and I believe it was old 32 Chevy of Hill Benson's. And we were all loaded to shoot something, because the shotgun was a cure for everything.
It was very clever. It was very imaginative, the use of interrupting a program with urgent news about far distant events was not unknown to Americans at the time. In fact, becoming fairly familiar with this kind of technique. And he did so quite deliberately to lend a sense of what could be called radio vérité, in the sense of this is how radio really sounded.
In May 1937, the previous year, radio reporter Herbert Morrison had set up his recording equipment on a landing field in New Jersey to chronicle the arrival of the German passenger airship, the Hindenburg.
The back motors of the ship are just holding it just enough to keep it from... It bursts into flames. Keep...
Out of the way, sir!
Get this started. It's flashing. It's burning, bursting into flames, and it's falling on the mooring fast. And all the folks between us, this is terrible. This is one of the worst catastrophes in the world. It's a terrific crash, ladies and gentlemen. The smoke and the flames now. I can't talk to people. I can hardly breathe. I'm going to step inside where I cannot see it.
35 people died when the Hindenburg caught fire and exploded before his very eyes.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's indescribable. I can hardly force myself to keep looking at it. It's so awful. The things rising up now, and the crowd falls back. It seems plenty.
In The War of the Worlds, Carl Phillips, the fictional reporter played by Frank Reddick, modelled his delivery on that recording.
Hold on, will you please? I'll be right back in a minute.
Such use of the conventions of news broadcasting to add credibility and liveness to radio dramas had actually been heard before here in Britain. Joanna Burke.
12 years before this panic, of course, we had one in Britain. We had broadcasting from the barricades.
The Savoy Hotel has now been blown up by the crowd. That noise, which you heard just now, was the Savoy Hotel being blown up by the crowd at the instigation of Mr. Poppleberry.
In 1926, Father Ronald Knox, then a well-known scholar, broadcaster and expert on Sherlock Holmes, interrupted a BBC radio talk on 18th-century literature with a report that Big Ben had been toppled, the Savoy Hotel torched, and a government minister lynched by a panic-stricken mob.
This very, very influential broadcaster, Father Knox, very popular broadcaster, who basically goes on and tells the story about the unemployed sort of massing in Trafalgar Square and having this huge riot.
The actual broadcast is lost to history, but in 2005, a Radio 4 programme, The Riot That Never Was, reconstructed it using the original script.
The Admiralty Arch is being poured through by a crowd lately collected in Trafalgar Square, and the back of the government buildings in Whitehall is being approached in a threatening manner.
And people really did believe it. Near the end of that broadcast, we hear the mob going into the Savoy Hotel and destroying it. People, you know, rang up the Savoy Hotel, you know, should we cancel our bookings, what's happening? It was a very, very real panic.
Evening Standard. The BBC has unintentionally been responsible for the biggest scare known in Britain since the advent of broadcasting. Half the country over the weekend has been flooded with rumours of a great upheaval in London, and all because Father Ronald Knox broadcast some extracts from an imaginary news bulletin.
Sounds a bit stilted, but could that broadcast have influenced Orson Welles? John Gosling.
I find it unlikely. He was 10 years old at the time. John Houseman, who was educated in England, had already moved to the States. The story was mentioned in the New York Times, and rather embarrassingly for the Times. They actually stated such a thing could never, ever happen in the United States, of course. Could Wells or Houseman have read that? Could Houseman have received a letter from home telling him about it? Possibly. But I think if you're looking for something that could have influenced Wells, and that's a show called Air Raid.
One moment now, we'll try to take you through.
Now, that was done for the Columbia Workshop, which was a rival show, a very similar sort of sustaining show. It was similar. It took the idea of presenting an attack on a fictional town in the style of a news broadcast, with somebody reporting on it. Not to the same intensity that Wells engineered. It's also notable that Wells lent one of his actors to that show, so Wells could have almost certainly heard it, maybe read the script, perhaps had something fed back from his actor. So I think that's a much more likely influence.
We can hear the influence of Air Raid in War of the Worlds as Lieutenant Vogt leads a squadron of fighter bombers bravely taking on the Martian invaders.
Langham Field, enemy tripod machines now in sight, reinforced by 3 machines from the Morristown cylinder, 6 altogether, 1 machine partially crippled, believed hit by shell from army gun in Wachung Mountains. Guns now appear silent. A heavy black fog hanging close to the earth of extreme density, nature unknown. No sign of heat ray. Enemy now turns east, crossing Passaic River into the Jersey marshes. An
Another straddles the Pulaski Skyway.
12, 15 minutes into the program, the phone started ringing. And the first one I picked up, a hysterical person, said, "The Martians are invading. What do we do? What do we do?" And I said, "They're not invading. It's a radio show. It's Orson Welles and the Mercury Theater. Calm down. You know, it's just a radio program."
At CBS, the immediate extent of the panic was brought home to Hal Davis, who was manning the phones that night. Meanwhile, the founder of CBS, William S. Paley, had his evening ruined.
I wasn't listening to it. I was at home playing cards and remember it very well. I was annoyed by it because I got all kinds of telephone calls about something. These telephone calls were coming in. And they wouldn't say what they wanted, but they would want to talk to Mr. Paley or whoever was president of CBS. And I'd say, "These people are calling up to make some complaints." I get these all the time, and I'm sick and tired of them. Until finally I got a call from the office saying, "Oh, Mr. Paley, a terrible thing has happened." And there it was, the whole country was bursting wide open.
There were people who went into bars and started screaming that the world was coming to an end, and the bartenders would turn on CBS, and sure enough, here were the Martians coming.
Professor Susan Douglas.
People began calling police stations to find out what was going on. There were people around the metropolitan area of New York where people did get damp towels to put over their faces to protect themselves from gas and jumped in their cars and started heading out of town.
Joanna Burke, author of Fear, A Cultural History.
People would look out their window, and if they didn't see anyone outside their window, they would think, "Oh, goodness, people are gassed. Our neighbours have been gassed." Of course, if they looked outside the window and did see people outside the window, they thought, "Ah, our neighbours are also frightening and are panicking." So they sort of interpret all evidence to sort of fit their preconceived ideas.
I was in the control room, sitting next to the CBS, our supervisor. And he got a call and suddenly got up and left rather precipitately. Then he came back about 3 minutes later, white as a sheet, said, "We've got to stop the show. John, you've got to stop the show. You've got to stop it." And I interposed my body between him and Orson and said, "No, no, never, never. You can't ruin the show." But by then, I'd had calls in the control room from governors of states and saying, "What is this? Is it, if this is a joke, we're coming down and we're going to punch you in the nose." I mean, the second half of the show is totally uncontroversial. It's pure H.G. Wells, and it's the two last survivors on the Earth after the, by accident, they've survived. Then as soon as we finished the show, I or David or somebody went up to Orson and said, "Look, you've got to make an explanation because this hell is broken loose, right? And I can't tell you what, but just make an explanation." So he made his set speech, which was all about Halloween. "Oh, that was our little Halloween joke," and so and so.
"This is Orson Welles, ladies and gentlemen, out of character to assure you that the War of the Worlds has no further significance than as the holiday offering it was intended to be. The Mercury Theater's own radio version of dressing up in a sheet and jumping out of a bush and saying boo. Starting now, we couldn't soap all your windows and steal all your garden gates by tomorrow night, so we did the best next thing. We annihilated the world before your very ears and utterly destroyed the CBS. You will be relieved, I hope, to learn that we didn't mean it and that both institutions are still open for business."
John Houseman.
Then when it was over, CBS sent dozens of house police into the studio. They snatched all the scripts and they hustled Orson and me into some room, some back room. And they kept us there for about half an hour. Then the press was released to us. The press was very sore at radio. Radio had displaced them as the prime news medium. So they made the most of it. They would do things like, "Well, you've heard about the family of five that was killed on the New Jersey highway. Have you heard any more around the country?" So that we believed for the next 2 or 3 hours that we were mass murderers.
"Were you aware of terror at the time you were giving this role? Were you aware that terror was going on throughout the nation?"
"Oh, no, of course not."
You must realize that when I left the broadcast last night, I went into dress rehearsal for a play that's opening in 2 days, and I've had almost no sleep, And I know less about this than you do. I haven't read the papers except...
What was the first thing you had?
One doesn't believe in the radio audience much. You don't know whether they're listening or not. You have no idea how many people are listening or what they're thinking. I had every hope that the people would be excited as they would be at a melodrama.
Do you think there ought to be a law against such enactments as we had last night?
I don't know what the legislation would be. I know that almost everybody in radio would do almost anything to avert the kind of thing that has happened, myself included, but radio is new and we are learning about the effect it has on people. Learned a terrible lesson.
John Houseman.
We kept saying, sorry, sorry, sorry. We didn't mean it. We didn't mean to frighten you. We didn't mean to scare you.
Turning the meeting over to us, sir?
I am, for the moment.
He's turning it over
to us. 2 years after the broadcast, in 1940, Orson Welles and H.G. Wells met. A San Antonio radio station recorded this historic encounter.
I've known his work before he made this sensational Halloween spree. Are you sure there was such a panic in America, or wasn't it your Halloween fun?
Mr. Hitler made a good deal of sport of it, you know, and actually spoke of it in the Great Munich speech, you know. And there were floats in Nazi parades.
Much else to say.
That's right. Much else to say. And it's supposed to show the corrupt condition and decadent state of affairs in democracies that the War of the Worlds went over as well as it did.
We had articles about it, and people said, have you never heard of Halloween in America when everybody pretends to see ghosts? Yes.
Well, there was some excitement caused. I really can't belittle the amount that was caused, but I think that the people got over it very quickly, don't
what
you?
What kind of excitement?
Sometimes it's estimated that 1 million people were panic-stricken or pitched into hysteria. That is a complete exaggeration.
Professor W. Joseph Campbell believes that such stories have been vastly exaggerated.
Pretty clear that most listeners recognized this show for what it was, good radio entertainment.
The rough estimate is that about 6 million people heard the show. About 1.7 million believed it to be authentic, and about 1.2 million were frightened. There were something on the order of 20 people treated for shock just in one of the Newark hospitals. So the impact was enormous. In the first 3 weeks after War of the Worlds, newspapers around the country ran almost 13,000 stories about its impact.
I've examined U.S. newspapers in metropolitan areas, 36 of them, in the days and weeks afterwards, and this story was quickly out of the paper. There may have been upwards of a million people or so who were frightened or disturbed, upset by what they heard, but that is a far cry from being pitched into panic and engaging in mass hysteria.
John Gosling.
Were there any deaths? No, definitely not. Were there any injuries? Maybe the odd sprained ankle. It was mainly, I think, bruised egos at the end of the day. People afterwards were just embarrassed to admit they'd been taken in by this extraordinary show.
Most people would have recognized, and most of them did, I believe, that events on this show, on Wells' program, were moving far too fast to be realistic. You know, within 30 minutes, the Martians blasted off from Mars, traveled millions of miles across space, landed on Earth, set up their deadly heat rays, and began to annihilate elements of the U.S. Army, and then marched on to New York City. I mean, things were just moving far too quickly. And that alone was one of the tip-offs to radio listeners that, hey, it's a good show, but, you know, this is not real.
Well, of course, there was some exaggeration. There were a lot of factors at play. Some thought that the print press had an axe to grind. Some of the stories sent out were repeated, unverified, and verbatim from the news wires. So there's no guarantee that all these stories were entirely true. But equally, I dispute the idea that it was excessively exaggerated. I think the problem arises when you start using phrases like mass panic to describe this. And it wasn't a mass panic. In fact, it's fairly certain that there probably never has been a mass panic in history, though I think the needle was quivering backwards and forwards, and it quivered awfully close to mass panic, but it never quite got there.
I think there is a degree of exaggeration about people's responses, partly because it makes a much better story to talk about, you know, people jumping into cars and throwing their, you know, loved possessions and indeed loved ones in behind them. I don't think anyone is really saying that there wasn't a panic, that people weren't very, very anxious and upset. They may have interpreted it in very different ways to the ways our newspaper editors and journalists wish to narrate. But certainly a lot of people were very, very frightened.
A lot of the blame for stories of nationwide panic is perhaps to be laid at the door of newspapers, getting their revenge on the upstart medium of radio.
Newspaper editorials in the days immediately after the program were vigorous, if not vicious, in condemning radio for this program.
Professor W. Joseph Campbell.
William Randolph Hearst, New York Journal and American, claimed there were hundreds of thousands of people into the streets. So the newspaper editorials, the leaders in newspapers in this country, were, in my view, partly responsible for embedding this myth.
During the years that have gone by since then, I've heard a number of stories about the things that happened. Some of them may seem hard to believe, but they're all verified. You'll find them in a very scholarly book which Princeton University got out on the subject of mass hysteria.
A few years on from the broadcast, in 1940, some research was carried out by a Princeton University psychologist called Hadley Cantrill, and it was published under the title The Invasion from Mars, A Study in the Psychology of Panic.
Hadley Cantrill presented his research into the topic and really established a baseline for the notion that there was widespread panic and mass hysteria that night, an audience size of an estimated 6 million and perhaps 1 million or so who were frightened and disturbed. Come from Hadley Cantrill's book and his research. How he developed that number is not entirely clear. It's a very soft and squishy number in any case. And then he included interviews with maybe three dozen people with whom he had spoken.
I never hugged my radio so closely as I did last night. I held a crucifix in my hand and prayed while looking out of my open window for falling meteors. I also wanted to get a faint whiff of the gas so that I would know when to close my window and hermetically seal my room with waterproof cement or anything else I could get hold of. My plan was to stay in the room and hope that I would not suffocate before the gas blew away. When the monsters were wading across the Hudson River and coming into New York, I wanted to run up to my roof to see what they looked like, but I could not leave my radio while it was telling me of their whereabouts.
Suddenly, the announcer was gassed. The station went dead, so we tried another station, but nothing would come on. Then we went to a gas station and filled up our tank in preparation for just riding as far as we could. The gas station man didn't know anything about it. And then one friend, male, decided he would call up the Newark Evening News. He found out it was a play. We listened to the rest of the play and then went dancing.
People in the streets see it now. They're running toward the East River, thousands of them, dropping in like rats. Now the smoke's spreading faster. It's reached Times Square. People are trying to run away from it, but it's no use. They're falling like flies. Now the smoke's crossing 6th Avenue. 5th Avenue, 100 yards away, it's 50 feet.
It was immediately after our show went off the air that Walter Winchell, who was on a rival network and had heard about how all the telephone lines had been jammed and all the excitement, said, "Mr. and Mrs. America, there is no cause for alarm. America has not fallen. I repeat, America has not fallen." Of course, that was really enough for that network. And by that time, there wasn't a phone you could get to really anywhere in the States. The highways were jammed with cars going one way or another. Those people who were in the cities were going to the hills, and those people who were in the hills were coming into the cities. And if you think this is an exaggeration, it's only a little while ago that I again ran into some workers, some welfare workers, Quakers and Red Cross people who had been up in the Black Hills of Dakota some 5 or 6 weeks after this broadcast, persuading the people to leave the mountains and go back home because the Martians really hadn't come.
Years later, he seemed to delight in saying just how much fear and panic had been spread that night, and how people were, you know, tearing their hair out or ripping their clothes because they were so frightened they didn't know what to do. He had already been on the cover of Time magazine, one of the leading newsweeklies in the United States, and he was destined for even greater fame with the famous motion picture Citizen Kane.
Scriptwriter Howard Koch.
Orson was coming out of an upstairs balcony or something, and Hausman was coming in from below. And Orson made this sign. It was a sign of, "We're in." And Hausman made the sign back. Now, that doesn't mean that they were overjoyed that there was a panic, but it did mean that they had accomplished something which was going to be very profitable to the show and to the careers and so on.
There are a surprising number of repeats. You would imagine that once something like this had happened, it wouldn't happen again. But it did.
In November 1944, an adaptation of the play caused a similar panic when it was broadcast in Santiago, Chile. And in February 1949, it once again stirred up a hornet's nest when it was performed by a radio station in Quito, Ecuador. John Gosling.
And it resulted in a really quite horrendous loss of life. It was a very similar production, highly localized, so using place names that people would recognize from the locality. And as the broadcast went on, panic erupted in the streets. This was, as described, much closer to a real mass panic. People were running about in their nightshirts. Priests were giving final absolution to impromptu congregations on street corners. After a while, as it became apparent to the people in the studio that something was going horribly wrong, they put out a disclaimer. And most people, I imagine, quite sheepishly went home, except for a furious mob of 300 or 400 people who marched on the station intent on revenge. The radio station was in the local newspaper offices on one of the top floors, and this mob turned up, set fire to newspapers and tossed them into the basement. It ignited the chemicals stored there, the printing presses went up, and worse still, they barricaded the doors so no one could escape. So the only option those trapped inside had was to either try and form human chains from the upper floors, which of course broke and people plummeted to the ground, or equally perilous, they had to attempt an escape across these rickety old rooftops with tiles crumbling underfoot, flying left, right and centre. And so these were the terrible options the cast, crew and newspaper staff faced.
One broadcaster stayed behind, though, and he was the last person on the air that night, a man called Luis Beltran. The American radio programme Radio Lab spoke to his daughter Maria about what happened to him when the radio station was stormed.
Well, at that point, when he realized the magnitude of the situation, he went back on the air and began pleading for help, pleading for assistance from the police and the fire department, but no help came because the police were going to fight the Martians. And eventually, he was the last one left. And he jumped out the window, I guess from either the third or fourth floor, onto a second floor balcony. To break the fall, he grabbed onto the railing of that balcony, and he was completely engulfed in flames at that point. And the skin on his hands just remained on the balcony. It was like a barbecue grill.
Wow.
From there, he jumped to the ground. But before he jumped, he was pleading to the crowd to, I guess, catch him. But they didn't. He landed on cement, ribs, everything, and compounded by the very, very serious burns that he had all over his body.
So he landed at the feet of an angry mob. What did
an angry mob, and he recalled that as he's losing consciousness, he just heard somebody say, just let him die in peace. Although some of the articles that I read, they tried to throw him back into the building.
Really?
Someone grabbed him and put him in a jeep to take him to the hospital, just a bystander. And, you know, he had so many scars here. As children, my brother and I would play with his scars. We would trace them with our finger and ask him what happened, you know, how he got the scars. And he would tell us about the fire.
And when the dust had settled, the death toll was set at 6 persons, burnt to death in this radio station.
The War of the Worlds has been called the most important radio broadcast in history. Would it be possible to present a War of the Worlds today, when we're so much more sophisticated about radio and cinema verite and so much more aware of media manipulation? Matt Locke is a former Channel 4 commissioner and now runs Story Things, a company which experiments with new narratives for the digital age.
Radio and TV were the products of an era of distribution in which we all received culture at exactly the same time and pretty much were isolated in our experience of it. There might be people in the room with us, our family, our friends, etc. But it was difficult to share the experience of listening to a broadcast or watching a broadcast outside of that very small group of people.
If you were doing the War of the Worlds today in the digital era, how would you make it work?
I think the biggest difference is obviously Orson Welles was operating in a world of distribution in which he told the story out, but he couldn't be challenged immediately by the audience. Whereas nowadays, we live in a world of call and response. It's much closer to, you know, being a music hall or variety artist than it is to being involved in TV or radio. You tell stories through iteration. You know, you tell a bit of a story and then you hear the response from the audience and then you tell a bit more of a story. So if you were doing War of the Worlds now, you would need to be able to keep up the pretense, to keep up the illusion over a longer period of time.
Do you think we're more or less gullible as a result in this year than we would have been in 1938?
I don't think gullibility levels go up or down at all. I think, you know, there are people being fooled all over the web in lots of interesting ways, and that makes it sometimes easier to fool people because you can create what are called sock puppets and you can mimic that network conversation and have fake voices in that conversation that actually do influence people. But it also makes it harder because you have to constantly be performing.
And then there were all these traffic cops. It was Sunday night, you see, and all these guys out in Jersey on their motorbikes, and the people in the cars driving had the radio, but the cops didn't. And suddenly, everybody started driving at 125 miles an hour. He said, pull over, now I'm going to the hills, you know.
Sensational. And if you wanted to terrify people today, how would
you? I don't. You know I didn't want to then.
No, of course. Of course.
What a suggestion.
But if somebody wanted to... terrify people today, how should they do it?
Well?
QX2L calling CQ, New York. Is there anyone on the air? Isn't there anyone? 2X2L.
How would they do it? What a question. Orson Welles and the War of the Worlds, Myth or Legend, was presented by Christopher Frayling and produced by Nick Frian-Jones from Hidden Flack Productions in the UK. I'm Lorena Allen. My thanks today to Joe Wallace.